From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. National protests against police violence came to New Hampshire over the weekend, although we didn't see the lootings, burnings, and violence seen elsewhere. In downtown Manchester on Saturday, a crowd of about 1,000 gathered without incident. A few hours later, a tense moment unfolded near the Manchester Police Department, which resulted in the arrests of a pickup truck driver and his passenger, who seemed to be threatening protesters with a gun. Saturday also saw smaller gatherings in support of Black Lives Matter elsewhere in the state. Then yesterday afternoon in Conway, there was another protest, this time with a local focus, controversy over the treatment of a Black motorist by state troopers during a traffic stop in mid-May. Exchange listeners, we want to know how you're feeling about all of this from a national and New Hampshire angle. And as always, we welcome your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Sudi Lett, Youth and Education Coordinator for the Granite State Organizing Project, which works on social justice issues. His father, Willard Lett, was a longtime head of the New Hampshire NAACP. Also with us, Michael Kerrigan, Chief of the Nashua Police Department. He's been an officer 26 years and chief for 9 months. He's promoted efforts to improve police relations with the city's African-American community. And also with us, Jordan Thompson, racial justice organizer for the ACLU of New Hampshire. He's also involved with Black Lives Matter and is the lead organizer of a vigil planned for next weekend in Nashua. Welcome to everybody. I really appreciate you joining us after what I'm sure was a difficult weekend. And Sudi, I do want to start with you. Did you imagine, Sudi, that the death of George Floyd that we have all seen at the hands of local police would spark the kinds of scenes that have erupted in the last 5 or 6 days?
No, I'm going to be honest, no. And the reason I say no is because we recently just saw Ahmaud gunned down weeks prior, you know, jogging while Black. So there wasn't the type of response that we've seen in Minneapolis. But after seeing that type of response from the community, it felt similar to Ferguson. And seeing the response around the country, it's been eye-opening, to say the least.
When you say eye-opening, Sudi, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that there has been a consistent effort of all different groups in this effort to really show unity and solidarity. I think that it's been amazing that despite the fact that we're in a global pandemic, people are literally risking their health to take to the streets in support of social justice, in support of Black people, in support of humanity. And that is really special, and it's something that has really caught the attention of everyone.
What went through your mind, Sudi, when you first learned of the death of George Floyd and the awful way that it happened with the police?
Well, for me, I have a lot of time to do research and learn about African history and Black history in America. And so for me, being that I've learned and seen many traumatic events, my first thought was to not re-injure myself and watch something that I knew would make me really upset. After seeing the response from family that I've been around and seeing their reaction to it, I immediately started to think, you know, what could be done in terms of strategizing to bring unity, in terms of strategizing to bring responsibility, and strategizing to bring some type of positive response out of something that was so clearly negative. I think it's really important that we take this time to try to pull together. And I mean, I've been on the internet and been on my phone and been in front of a computer like many of us have. And it's impossible not to see these things on those platforms. So I think for me, it's just about, you know, the positive response. I understand the response of the protesters. I understand the response of the people who are looting. You know, these people have been out of work for 3 months. They've been given a $1,200 stimulus check. And I don't think anyone on this call could live on $1,200 for 3 months. So the response that I'm seeing is an economic response. And it's a response that's a human response. If you didn't have food or diapers or all of these things that you need every day for your family, I could get that. Now, I do understand there are people out there that are just, you know, doing it to do it. But the problem is so big and there's so many factors that are playing at once. The things that went through my head were, you know, just wow. I mean, so many different things at once. 2 weeks ago, we were about to open the country up and people were, you know, protesting and speaking out against that. And 2 weeks later, they're taken to the streets. It's just things are moving really fast.
Yeah, and curfews imposed in some cities, so everything has been sort of boarded up again in some places. Aside from the violence that you mentioned, Sudi, and some of the emotions, you know, that people have about this killing, obviously, about other killings we've seen, but also just about the struggles that African-Americans in particular have had with this pandemic, what else has struck you about the demonstrations that you've seen, Sudi?
I think one of the things that struck me about the demonstration and my personal experience is that friends of mine who are Caucasian, white, you know, whatever, European, however you want to identify as, they've reached out to me to ask what they can do. And that has been new. That's never happened. I've had, you know, former players of mine that have reached out to say, you know, Sudi, I haven't posted anything publicly, but I don't know how to do that. You know, what should I say? What can I do? And I think that those are the first steps of what we need. I think that, you know, the humanity is what we're missing. And throughout this situation, the pandemic, throughout, you know, what's happened with George Floyd, throughout what's happened with many, many, many people in this country for a long, long time, you know, if we can just find a way to take a moment to pause, hopefully we can learn and strategize and heal because we're broken. And I think that that's been really clear.
When you say players, Sudi, just to let the audience know, you're the varsity coach.
Yeah.
And at Central. And I'm a little bit later. I would love to ask you how you're talking to the young people that you work with, because, you know, they're seeing this plastered all over their phones. You know, some of them are involved, and I'd love to hear from you a little bit later about how they're processing this. But Chief Kerrigan, I do want to turn to you. Many Americans by now have seen that image that Sudi mentioned that is so hard to watch of the white Minneapolis police officer kneeling on the neck of George Floyd, begs to be released, and then dies. So as a police officer, what goes through your mind when you see that, Chief Kerrigan?
Well, so I watched that video a couple of times. I didn't want to watch it a second or third time, but I felt it was my kind of responsibility to do so. And there's no way, shape, or form I can describe anything but horror. To watch that goes against everything that I believe in, goes against everything that I would hope most police officers believe in. You know, I was asking myself, breaking that video down different ways, well, how come the other officers didn't jump in and stop that? Would I have done that? How would we have handled that? How the people videotaping it, would, you know, the conversation I had with my son is, well, would I have gone in, and if I was a black man videotaping that, would I have gone in and risked being arrested to push the officers off to be allowed him to breathe? And the reality for those people there was no, because they could die doing that too. So it's a horrifying video. I've seen as many of the videos as I can, and I don't see any justification for that. And that's just, it mortifies me.
As a police officer and now a chief, you've been working to improve relations with minority communities in Nashua. So I'm guessing, Chief Kerrigan, this is extremely frustrating for you, almost like it diminishes the efforts that you're trying to make locally.
Yeah, I certainly felt a huge level of frustration. The one positive view I have is, you know, Jordan is one of the individuals that I've worked with a lot. I'm hoping the relationship that we've established over the last 5 years within the community helps. I want the, you know, in this case, particularly the black community, to know that I support them. I support how they're feeling. I can't claim to understand their point of view, but I can try. And I want them to know that I'm supportive of their frustration and everything that they're going through. It's hard for me because I feel like Nashua has a good relationship with the minority communities. We're not perfect, but we work hard to get close to it with the help of everybody. So it's frustrating to me to watch this unfold throughout the country and potentially risk violent protests in Nashua.
Well, I'm sure you're thinking about that. I wonder what you're saying to your officers now. You've been officer for a long time, chief for 9 months. So a tough time to be the leader of Nashua's police force. What are you saying to the officers under your command, Chief Kerrigan?
So it's important for us to understand, and again, this is not something, and I'd like to say something after, but this is not a conversation that happens right now, come in Monday morning. Well, this happened last week. This is how we have to respond. This conversation needs to happen over a period of time. And that period of time deals with when you're having the trainings with cultural competency or diversity training, those conversations have to happen then. So the understanding is there for the background and the history of why those feelings are there. It's not something that you can walk in on a Monday morning and say, hey, this happened, you need to feel this way. The understanding comes through time and through education, and that's difficult to always get to everybody within the PD, but I think it's a slow burn process, meaning it happens over time and it has to be constantly reinforced. The education has to be there, the relationship has to be there with the community, the conversations have to happen to understand each other's perspective and the willingness to be open to listen to the history in the background to understand kind of what that viewpoint is.
Well, and I'd like to ask you a little bit later about some of the efforts that you have made in terms of training and so forth. But just for the more immediate concern, Chief Kerrigan, it is your job to keep Nashua safe. And given that responsibility, how do you react when you see pictures of lootings and burnings and businesses destroyed? And, you know, you're obviously thinking about your own city.
Sure. You know, in an ideal world, Saturday night's going to go completely peaceful and we can show the police department support. However, we do have to prepare for people coming into Nashua with intentions of committing violence or stirring up any aggression. So we have a professional police department. We have people that are well-trained and we'll be prepared to respond to any acts of violence because the people of Nashua, the business owners, the residents, they don't deserve their have their property destroyed or their city in ruins because of outsiders coming in. And I really believe that people within Nashua feel connected to the police department and know that we're trying to always improve those relationships. So my concern is more from outsiders coming in.
Well, and Jordan, you've definitely talked about that concern as well. And I want to ask you about that. But just first of all, Jordan, what did you see at rallies in New Hampshire this weekend? How did they go?
They went really well. I saw a multicultural, multi-generational coalition of people from all different backgrounds and walks of life coming together to protest police brutality, state-sanctioned violence, white supremacy. And it brought me a lot of hope. You know, as you mentioned before, there was a really great showing in Manchester at the protest that was organized by Black Lives Matter Manchester. And I just want to highlight these individuals. Black Lives Matter Manchester is a group that is really comprised of just a few, you know, Black youth that are college-aged, Rennell, Terrell, Elijah, and a few others. They organized this protest, and it went incredibly well. We coordinated with the Manchester Police Department to make sure that tensions, you know, were not escalated, to make sure that the protesters were being protected and they would have a safe, you know, sort of route throughout the city. And so it was just very, very well organized. And as you mentioned, there was an incident later on at the police department that unfortunately escalated and resulted in the arrest of two folks who attempted to escalate a situation into something violent. But for the most part, it went very, very well. And I'm very, very proud of the work that was done.
How did protesters, Jordan, at the Manchester Police Department make their case? Because there were two events, right? There was a sort of rally march in downtown Manchester, but then there was another incident at the police department. So did that feel different to you?
Yes, there was certainly, you know, a difference in tone, I believe, in both of the events. The original protest that brought out, you know, 1,000 plus people that was organized by Black Lives Matter Manchester, the tone of that was very peaceful. It was very hopeful. It was very much about, you know, there is anger here, there's passion here, but we want to channel that anger into passion, and we want to channel that passion into change. We want something tangible. We don't want to just, you know, keep having these conversations and keep repeating the same, you know, hashtags and sort of buzzwords. We want to see something change in this moment. And so I think it was very, very productive. It was a very productive use of energy. And there were so many young people that it was just, it was so, so hopeful and so incredible. And I was so very proud to be a part of it. You know, I think the sort of shift in tone when it came to the demonstration that took place outside of, you know, the Manchester Police Department, you know, I think that was born out of frustration. You know, because I think the original protest had a sense of hopefulness. You know, some may have perceived it as leaving it open-ended. And there were people that were still really fired up about this issue. They wanted to see more police involvement. They wanted to see more police accountability. And so they went directly to meet the police where they were. You know, there was a sort of a tense exchange between, you know, law enforcement and some of the demonstrators, because they just wanted solidarity. They wanted the police officers to kneel with them, to take a moment of silence, to honor, you know, victims of police brutality like George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others. And, you know, as I said before, unfortunately, because of the actions of an outsider, of a Trump supporter who, you know, drove by and started yelling racial slurs to the crowd of mostly young people, of mostly youth, teenagers, it escalated into something that, you know, was certainly less than ideal. But, you know, they were there for the same goal as the original protest. They were there for the same mission. They wanted to see accountability. They wanted to see acknowledgement, and they wanted solidarity from members of law enforcement.
Regarding the national violence we've seen, Jordan, you know, the store windows smashed and buildings burned. You wrote on Facebook yesterday, and I'm quoting you here, Jordan, "If your intentions are inherently violent, you are not welcome at our events. Our goal is to honor the victims of police brutality and commit ourselves to reforming a system that has failed Black people in life and death. These events are centered on Black lives and liberation, and any attempts to hijack that message will not be tolerated." But as you know better than me, Jordan, there's so much anger. Black people are so, so sick and tired of these deaths again and again. So how do you, Jordan, as an organizer, acknowledge that rage, but keep it from spilling over into violence and destruction?
Yeah, what I will say is that, of course, there's a segment of Black and brown communities in these demonstrations that are, you know, very validly taking out their frustrations on a system that has failed them time and time again. But there's also precedent for outside groups of white supremacists and even members of law enforcement who come into these protests, who come into these demonstrations and seek to incite violence. There's historical precedent for it, and there is current precedent for it. And this is what we're seeing happen nationwide. There are many reports nationwide of peaceful protests that are turning into violent situations because we have majority non-Black demonstrators who are using this this movement as a vehicle for their own agenda. And ultimately, the problematic nature of that is that the Black and brown communities that are out there protesting peacefully are ultimately going to be held accountable for those violent actions that they are not condoning. And so we have to really take a look at you know, this issue from that angle. Of course, there are people who have every right to be angry. Of course, there are people you know, that, you know, want to see change. And I'm one of them. And, you know, I wanna, you know, sort of shout out, you know, the chief here, because I have worked with him over the past 5 years. And I was one of those angry protesters. You know, the first time that I met Chief Kerrigan, it was in 2015 or 2016. And this was at a community forum about police relations, about race relations. And we had a very frank conversation. We had sort of the back and forth. And at first it wasn't a conversation. It was like me shouting at him. But of course, that's not a conversation. You know, I was talking at him rather than with him. I was listening to respond to him rather than listening to understand where he was coming from. And I would even argue vice versa. But once we sort of took down those barriers, we were able to see maybe our differences in perspectives, but there was a real desire to work together to fix some of these issues. And over the past 5 years, we have worked together hand in hand on a variety of community initiatives to address these issues within our community. And as he said, the Nashville Police Department is not at all by any means perfect, but they have made considerable strides on these issues. They have made considerable strides to address the very valid concerns of Black and Brown people in this community. And for that, I am grateful. But it is something that is truly a lifelong struggle. This is lifelong work that we must commit and dedicate ourselves to.
Wow, there's so much more to talk about, but I want to bring our listeners in as well, gentlemen. And again, our phone number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We want you to weigh in on just how you're feeling, your questions, comments, reactions to all that we saw over the weekend in this country. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, James is calling from Goffstown. Hi, James. You're on the exchange. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, Laura. How are you?
Okay.
Good. And how are you, guests? Glad to have Sudi and John and Chris there. There's some really good comments, and you know, from the Manchester branch of the NAACP's perspective, which I, as you know, took over leadership back in February. We were just so pleased to see the peaceful protest on Saturday, and I was there and felt the energy. And I really wanted to support something Sudi said earlier around channeling, and John said this too, channeling this tremendous energy in positive ways. And I've been reached out to as well from people who have been asking, what can we do? What can we do now? And I my recommendation for when they asked before Saturday was come to the protest. But this is really lifelong work, as John said. And what we're stressing is first, people need to learn about the challenges. People need to then choose. There's so many different areas where change needs to take place from a systemic perspective, as John said. So people need to look at the various areas, be it education, be it economics, be it healthcare, be it environment, be it criminal justice. Decide where your passion is, which area you have most knowledge about and most passion about. And then commit to engaging with the people who are part of those systems and making up those systems, the power dynamics of those systems. And
so this is James. Yeah. Sorry to jump in. So just want to clarify for the audience, this is James McKim. You're the relatively new head of the Manchester NAACP. Is that right, James?
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Well, it's good of you to call in. I did want to ask you, you know, since this all blew up 5 or 6 days ago, what kinds of conversations you've been having with police officials around the state, James?
I've been having conversations with a number of officials across the state, and really having the conversations in the wake of an incident up in Albany, New Hampshire. Talking with State Police Commissioner Quinn and Colonel Noyce, and then having conversations with the Manchester Police, Captain O'Keefe and others, and the mayor, and just really trying to make sure that we have this relationship going that Jonathan talked about with the Nashua Police Chief, just making sure that we help them to understand the anger that is felt, and talk about how do we bring everyone to the table and decide what positive change we can make. And that vision of solidarity from the police force that Jonathan talked about, how do we achieve that? How does the police make that happen? So those are the discussions that I've been having that I really want to encourage people to try to engage with the police in non-threatening situations.
Yeah. All the harder. It's interesting, you know, you're talking about everybody coming to the table, and I hear you. it crossed my mind, James. It's hard to do this right now. We're in a pandemic and we're supposed to be, you know, all on Zoom.
That's right. It is difficult to do, but even on Zoom, I know a number of people are realizing that what we're doing here around the pandemic really is physical distancing, but we have technology that allows us to not necessarily have to social distance.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have been sort of, let's make that distinction between physical distancing and social distancing. James, I'd love to follow up with you maybe in a couple weeks on this topic, but I'm going to let you go for now because I got to take a station break and I want to hear from our listeners. I'm really glad you called in today. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And thanks for the program and thanks to the panelists and good luck to everybody.
Thanks a lot, James. Again, that's James McKim calling in, the head of the Manchester NAACP. And we will go back with our guests in just a moment. And we'll take more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. And your emails, exchange@nhpr.org. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Granite State voices weigh in on national protests over police violence toward African Americans. We'd love your thoughts, Exchange listeners, your reactions, your questions about all that we've seen in our country over the past few days after protests first erupted in Minneapolis. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests with us. Jordan Thompson, racial justice organizer for the ACLU-NH. He's also involved with Black Lives Matter. Also, Michael Kerrigan, chief of the Nashua Police Department, and Sudi Lett, youth and education coordinator for the Granite State Organizing Project. And Sudi, what have you heard from the young people that you work with? Again, I just said you're youth and education coordinator at GSOP. You also are the basketball coach at Central High School. What are you hearing from your young people about how they're feeling and how they're interpreting this moment?
The youth are fearless. I mean, I am so inspired by them. I mean, the youth that I spoke to directly told me that they went to the protest at Manchester. They said that they felt inspired by the event. They told me the event was good. And they even said, you know, the police was there and they protected us. You know, like, I think those are the kind of first steps towards where we want to go. Here on the ground in Chicago, a city with completely, completely different demographics than our state of New Hampshire, the youth are much more active downtown and doing the things that get the media coverage that we don't, you know, that we don't like. But for the youth, I can't imagine what type of school year they've had. If I'm a senior, you know, I missed out on prom. I missed out on graduation. My college future is in flux due to the disease. And then on top of it, here I am facing police brutality and, you know, institutional racism and all these different things. For a teenager and even for the youth that are elementary age, it's got to be taxing on them. And you know, one of the main things that when I talk to the youth about, and they get so upset with what's going on, how do I, you know, kind of talk them off a ledge, is I just say things like, you know, I know you're upset about George Floyd and you have every right to be upset, but were you this upset about the people of Flint not getting water? You know, were you this upset about the KKK jingle that happened here in our own state in New Hampshire? You know, there's many, many things that there are to get upset. The viciousness of the George Floyd murder and the brutality of it obviously incites, you know, extreme emotion. But amongst our youth, I try to let them get a chance to pause and take a step back and look at the totality of everything. You know, racism to me is similar to COVID. You know, it's a disease. It's a disease. It's something that we don't have a lot of information about. It's something that, and what I mean by not having a lot of information, but for solutions, you know, there's no vaccine for racism. There's no vaccine for COVID-19. But I think the very idea of how we deal with that disease is similar to how we should think about racism. You know, here the four of us, we're away from each other. We're not able to, you know, sit in your lovely studio. That is awesome. But the four of us, you know, we're social distancing, obviously for our own health and for the health of our family, but we're social distancing for everyone. You know, we're trying to stop the spread everywhere. And so the idea is that, you know, is my social distancing in Manchester, is that affect people in Concord? And one would think, well, you know, obviously, yeah, you know, you want people to stay in place. It's the same idea with racism. You know, if I treat this young Black person with respect and with dignity, does that affect one in Concord? And the idea is that it does. You know, these instances where we're putting this positive energy into each other, it helps. And we have to continue to do that type of thing, just the same way we have to social distance. For our youth, I tell them, you know, it's cool that you guys are outside. Please wear a mask, you know, take hand sanitizer with you, because COVID is still active. But I'm never going to tell you to not speak out against inequality, to not speak out against things that you think aren't for the greater good of humanity. I mean, that's what being an American citizen should all be about anyway. So it's a really trying time for the youth. It's a really trying time for the adults. But this disease that we have in the United States and in the world that is racism, you know, it's going to take everyone. And so far, so good. Jordan said it earlier, it's been intergenerational and it's been multicultural. And I think that's what it needs to be, because racism is intergenerational and racism is multicultural. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. It's I mean, obviously, it goes without saying, it is a trying time for everybody, but especially, and you just kind of talked about this, Sudi, especially for African-American kids, you know, because of this added impact of the coronavirus on African-American communities, because of yet another Black person, you know, dying at the hands of police. And we know so much now, Sudi, about young people and how their brains are forming, you know, all up until age 25, and how early trauma can literally kind of shape your worldview and shape how you can succeed or not. So I just wonder how you see that, worry about that. It sounds like you're trying to offer almost like a positive, to use your coronavirus analogy, a positive antidote to that negative illness that is affecting people, especially young people of color.
Absolutely. You know, I talk to them about, you know, even sharing their stories. A big thing about community organizing, youth organizing, you know, we share our stories a lot so that we're able to communicate and, you know, come across to each other. And so I talk to them about, you know, if I was in Iraq and I went through a really traumatic situation, I wouldn't go on a tour and share the stories of my battle buddies dying, because of how traumatic it was. So we have to be careful in how we deal with trauma. I have not watched that video. I can tell you and the listeners, I have not watched it because I am not trying to re-injure myself with that type of trauma. You know, for the 12-year-old, they may not even know what that's doing to their brain watching that over and over.
Well, that's what I wonder. They see it, they're saturated with it. And it does, it is trauma to watch that again and again.
And it's traumatic. You know, the chief spoke really eloquently, and you can hear it in his voice how it makes you feel. It makes you feel sick, you know. And so for me, I try to take a pause, understand where we are in the grand scheme of things, and try to pick out the positive things that are happening, which are many white allies of mine have reached out. Many of the youth of mine have reached out. I've had family members reach out, and those are the things, those are the building blocks that we can start to kind of do this internal work that we need to do.
Well, speaking of that, I want to ask all of you about some other stories that have just started to filter out And these are the cases, and Jordan, I'll turn to you first, but Chief Kerrigan, I want to hear from you too. Jordan, I'm sure you know where I'm going with this. There have been cases where sheriffs have marched with protesters. In several instances, officers knelt in solidarity with protesters or walked down the street with them holding hands. So I just wonder what your response is to that, Jordan, and are you surprised to see some officers actually taking a knee or linking arms with protesters and walking down the street?
Yeah, you know, I've seen it in some cases, as you mentioned, and I'm glad to see it. You know, I'd love to see more of it, but what I don't want to see is this performance, right? Because I don't want to see these officers kneeling with protesters or demonstrators, and then an hour later, they're shooting rubber bullets at the crowds and injuring people. That is not, you know, that's not what solidarity looks like. That's performative, and that's not helping anybody. You know, you can kneel as long as you'd like for the photo op, but unless you're making these real changes to your conduct, it means nothing, and it helps no one. But I really want to speak to what Sudhi was talking about the trauma that, you know, particularly Black youth, Black and brown youth are dealing with. You know, this did not happen in a vacuum. These are kids who grew up watching the Ferguson protests on TV with little accountability, who saw Trayvon Martin gunned down and his killer still walks free today, who saw, you know, Sandra Bland, you know, die under very suspicious circumstances in that Texas County jail, and still her family has no closure. There's no justice for her. We have witnessed this over the past decade, and we, you know, witnessed the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement, and very little has changed for young people. Very little has changed for Black and brown youth, and so folks are tired. You know, folks want to see real systemic reform, and so we have to have conversations that move way beyond these gestures of solidarity and support. Though they are, you know, welcome and great, we got to do better. We got to see more, and we have to speak to that power imbalance, because these are folks who are sworn to serve and protect and defend these communities, and when you're, you know, as we saw at the Boston protests last night, when you are shooting tear gas into crowds that are peaceful, when you are utilizing military-grade weaponry to, you know, escalate a situation, when your literal job description is to de-escalate situations, you are doing no one any service.
Jordan, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, you can go ahead.
Well, and towards that point that you just made, Jordan, and I want to turn to Chief Kerrigan. So, you know, it's great that some cops are taking a knee, as Jordan said, and you know, linking arms, but more is needed. You have been trying, Chief Kerrigan, to do more. You've been involved with a group called Nashua Community Conversation on Race and Justice to improve community police relations. Your department trains police in cultural competency and implicit bias. We could talk for a whole hour, I mean, just about those efforts. But for now, Chief Kerrigan, what is that training trying to transmit to police? What is the main message that's trying to give to your officers?
Well, I guess I'll start by saying, can never say that the police department is doing this or that type of training or that type of education, because it's truly a partnership. That Nashua's Community Conversation of Race and Justice, Jordan's a part of it. There's several different minority community members that are a part of it. And we're all working together to develop the program. So it's not just something the police department is doing. It's everybody in the community who has a stake is participating. And that's, I think it's an important distinction, because it's not just something that we're doing. It's something that everybody is doing to help the relationship between groups. So I want to make that point, you know, very, very clear. The message I'm trying to get, or the message that I hope that the police officers get out of this or any of the type of training we do, is to be aware of different cultures. And it doesn't, I know right now this is a you know, police officers or police versus Black issue, which I don't diminish that, because it's very important and it's very significant right now. But I want the police officers to always be able to recognize different cultures and what that cultural perspective is. And if they can do that, they may take a step back and be a little bit better in how they handle those interactions with anybody at any level, whether it be positive, whether it be negative. If you can understand what Jordan's perspective may be as a young Black man, how's he looking at what's going on right now? I might be better able to handle that interaction in a positive way, that I can accomplish the infraction or whatever the interaction is in a constructive, positive way where he doesn't feel threatened. I'm trying to accomplish the goal that I am. And we both walk away saying, okay, he was professional. He cared about me, or he recognized me. So it's important for me, for my officers, to learn and be cognizant that different cultures approach things differently. And we have to be aware of it and be respectful of it and appreciate that, because those cultures may bring after some pretty, pretty unique and dynamic things and value to this city. And I think it's great. I think it's perfect for Nashville.
I got an email that came in from Tom in Canterbury, Chief, that I'll throw to you. Tom says, why isn't there personality profiling or screening for police to try to prevent radical behavior? What is done now that isn't working? What could be done to improve police officers' adherence to their creed? And Tom, thank you for writing in. And I wonder about that, Chief, in the hiring process. Can you really figure out if someone is going to react badly in a particular situation?
Well, that's a great question from him. And I can speak to the National Police Department, and what I would recommend to all police departments throughout the country is the level of scrutiny that goes into recruiting and hiring and conducting a background investigation into the officers is critical to bringing in the right people. We have several levels of interviews, background tests, polygraph tests, drug tests, psychological tests, both written and meeting with a psychologist, to try to identify any of those high-risk behaviors or lack of intelligence or willingness to be open to other people. And then if they don't meet those levels, they're not hired. And I think that's critically important to the success of minimizing that risk of officers. I also think it's critical, and you'll hear me say all the time, we spend an awful lot of money on training, and not just tactical training, but cultural awareness training, mental health, first aid training, all these different things that educate the officers and educate the people who work here on how to identify different cultures and how to be aware of things and how to better handle those based on what the experts are telling us. So I think the time and energy you put into backgrounding officers is critical, and the training that you offer them and provide to them every single year is of utmost importance to minimize the risk of hiring bad officers. And finally, I'll say, if you do have officers that that either cross that line or are not who you want working in the community, there's a mechanism to discipline and get them fired. And I think it's important for people to know that there are officers here or anywhere, but our policies are, if they don't follow those rules and they are problematic, particularly around cultural issues, we'll fire them. They don't belong here. They don't represent the police department. They don't serve the community as to what we want. And you need to be able to step up and say, this person does not deserve to be a police officer.
We will follow up on that and a lot more after a short break. And we'll keep taking your emails like Tom did. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. Thank you, Tom. We'll keep taking your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, New Hampshire reaction to the protests and unrest sweeping the country over police violence toward African Americans. And Exchange listeners, we really want to hear from you. How do you react to all that we've seen in our country after protests first erupted in Minneapolis? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. Chief Michael Kerrigan is with us. He's chief of the Nashville Police Department. He's been there 26 years, chief for 9 months. Also with us, Jordan Thompson, racial justice organizer for the ACLU of New Hampshire, and he's involved with Black Lives Matter. And Sudhi Lett, youth and education coordinator for the Granite State Organizing Project. One more time, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And Chief Kerrigan, just before the break, you were talking about what you try to do with the Nashville Police Force, all sorts of training and education and, you know, best practices, recruitment. I've talked to a lot of police departments around the state, and many are trying to recruit among minority communities. How's that going for you in Nashua?
It's an immense challenge for us. We're trying really hard to be able to attract minorities. My goal is to have a population of police officers that reflect better what the community population is. And that's bring in Latino officers, bring in Black officers, bring in Indian officers, bring in Brazilian officers. Those are all groups that we're trying to attract because we have large populations in Nashua. We've struggled with attracting the Black community, and I don't know why. Some of the groups that I work with, and Jordan's a part of, I try to ask, and how can we attract candidates? How can we reach out and have them come and test? And we're still struggling with it. I'd be more than welcome to ideas. I'd be more than welcome to support. We have a youth program that I would encourage young Black officers to get in, or anybody to get involved with, kind of show what police life is like. So I'm certainly open to ideas for that.
Yeah, well, I know police departments around the state are also facing shortages because younger people in general just aren't getting into the force the way that they used to. Sudi, what do you make of not just the chief's difficulties in Nashua, but departments around the state are having a hard time attracting recruits in general, but especially African Americans? How do you think, Sudi, police departments could create a more diverse force?
I think the best bet is to just educate the officers we have. We live in, I think, the fourth whitest state in the country. And so there's just not a lot of diversity in our state. So instead of trying to conjure up ways to try to attract people, I think the best way for everyone is to take a minute to do this internal work, you know, of looking at why would a Black person not want to be a police officer? Well, you know, the short answer is, if you saw someone come into your neighborhood and do negative things, would you want to be a part of that? No. So, you know, like, we need to do a lot of this internal work in terms of studying the history of policing. And there's a lot of historical precedent, and I mean going all the way back, for police and their relation to African-American people. But over this time during Corona, I've been reading a lot of books about just American history and trying to find out, you know, how we got here. And one of the things that I really came across is that in our history books and our textbooks and the things that we teach the students, you know, we teach about slavery, Black people, white people. White people are the masters, Black people are the slaves. You know, that's just an incomplete picture. You know, there were free Black people during that time that owned businesses. You know, there were white people at the time that fought out against slavery. You know, there were abolitionists that tried to put in laws to emancipate Black people. So we need to, like, get the complete full picture, because in the example that I just gave, most people don't want to talk about slavery. For good white people, they don't want to see instances where they're not good white people. For Black people that are doing really well, they don't want to see instances where they're not doing really well. But reading and understanding the history, you'll see that that's just half of the story. You know,
so
there
Sudi,
were people.
In terms of the police, it sounds like you're saying that's interesting. Don't, you know, given that New Hampshire's not a very diverse state, you know, rather than try to find minority candidates to join the police force, just work well with what you have. That's actually kind of interesting to hear you say that, Sudi.
I mean, we're going through a similar thing in education. In Manchester, the demographics of our high schools don't reflect what the demographics of our city are. Most of our educators are white. Most of the students are people of color. So, you know, we have a situation where we would love to attract more people of color who are educators to our state. We're unable to do that. It's similar with the police work. I'm sure the chief would love to have a more diverse police staff so that he's able to police effectively to his entire community. We don't live in that state. So because we're not in that state, we need to focus on what we have and try to do better with what we have.
Jordan, how do you feel that state leaders have responded to all this, starting with Governor Sununu, who said on Saturday, "This morning I called the organizers ahead of the George Floyd march in Manchester to let them know the state of New Hampshire stands with them in their calls for justice." The governor said, I'm quoting his statement here, "This important conversation must continue and we must constructively work together as a nation to ensure there is change." I wonder what you think about that message from the governor, Jordan, and other messages that you've gotten from, you know, top officials like the state attorney general's office or the New Hampshire Associations of Chiefs of Police and so forth.
Yeah, to be clear, you know, I don't think I've read or heard anything from, for example, the attorney general's office or the chief of police's office. But I was around for Governor Sununu's call when he phoned the organizers. You know, this is what I was saying earlier. You know, the gestures are nice, the gestures are great, but action is a lot better. And I would love to see more of that. What I didn't hear in his statement was an acknowledgement of state-sanctioned violence. What I didn't hear in his statement was acknowledgement of racism or white supremacy. I think it's really easy to sort of find a message that is like sort of moderate and can be palatable to different groups of people so that you're not, you know, politically leaning one way or politically leaning another way in an election year. But, you know, we don't need politicians who are going to sort of put an emphasis on what is, you know, careful or what is palatable to please everyone. We need people in positions of leadership who are going to stand on the side of justice, who are going to stand on the side of accountability and really center the most vulnerable of our marginalized groups in their messaging. And so my reaction to that is, you know, thanks for the call. Great. But, you know, my call to you is that we need a call to action.
You're organizing, speaking of a call to action, Jordan, as I said earlier, a vigil next weekend in Nashua. What's the best possible outcome for you, Jordan, with that event? And how are you preparing as much as possible to make that hope a reality?
Yeah, the best possible outcome for the vigil on Saturday is that we have a conversation that is facilitated. You know, as the chief mentioned, you know, I would say have a relatively good relationship with our police department. But as people look at what's happening nationally, as people look at what's happening statewide and other agencies and departments that may not have as good as of a relationship with their community, there are a lot of tensions. There's a lot of hostility. There's a lot of frustration, and all of it is valid. So I just seek to validate those frustration. I seek to validate that anger and sort of try to convince people that, you know, the only way for us to have a real change, to make a real difference in people's lives, is to, you know, seek systemic reform and to start having those conversations. I'm going to be very cognizant, because we have seen this happen at different demonstrations over the past couple of days, that, as I was talking about before, there are going to be outside forces that come in and attempt to incite violence, that attempt to instigate. But as I said in my statement, you know, any hijacking of the message that is about centering Black lives and liberation is not going to be tolerated. I mean, period. So, you know, we have to acknowledge that there are those that are going to utilize this movement and this circumstance to further their own interests that may not necessarily be in line with the interests of people who are focused on Black lives and liberation. But I really want to center, you know, specifically the victims of state-sanctioned violence and police brutality. We need to be talking about these people more often. I think sometimes in these conversations, it becomes sort of like an intellectual or academic debate rather than something that, you know, about something that actually affects people's lives. And so we have to talk about the nuances. We have to talk about the disparities. We have to be talking about the most vulnerable of our communities. You know, for example, the case of Breonna Taylor is being lost in a lot of this coverage. You know, a Black woman who was, you know, just chilling at home, who was murdered by law enforcement. She did nothing wrong. She committed no crime. There are Black women that are victims of police brutality, and their stories are being erased from every narrative. There are Black trans men and women and non-binary people who are victims of police brutality and state-sanctioned violence, and their stories are being erased and excluded from the narrative. So with this vigil, I want to bring the focus back to these people, to share their stories, to talk about
Human impact, Jordan, not just this sort of intellectual exercise, but real people with real lives who have been really harmed. That's going to be part of your focus. But as you said earlier on your Facebook page, if your intentions are violent, you are not welcome. We could have talked for 3 more hours. I really appreciate everybody being with us. Jordan, thank you very much, and we'll check in with you again. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Jordan Thompson, racial justice organizer for ACLU New Hampshire, also Black Lives Matter. Chief Kerrigan, it was good to talk to you too. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you much. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's Nashua's Police Chief Michael Kerrigan. He's been chief for 9 months after 26 years with the department. And Sudi Lett, great to have you. You've been in Chicago. You'll be back in New Hampshire in a couple days. Thank you very much for taking time out for us now, Sudi. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you.
See you later, Sudi. That's Sudi Lett, Youth and Education Coordinator for the Granite State Organizing Project. You've been listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.